Schroeder, good morning to you. You may approach.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. My name is Kent Schroeder. I'm from Kearney, Nebraska, and I represent the appellant, Dr. James Hotz. I seriously gave passing thought to submitting this case without argument. But there's two reasons that I'm standing here today. Tomorrow, the Nebraska Child Support Commission meets, and I thought about going to the Child Support Commission instead of talking to you. But it dawned on me, it's this court that makes the rules, and it's the commission that makes the suggestions. The second reason is Judge Castle. I feel very fortunate that Judge Castle is sitting to hear this case today, because Judge Castle probably knows more about the etiology of the formation of the Nebraska Child Support Guidelines than any person in this room. So, permit me to share with you just a little history about the Child Support Guidelines that are in place today. In 1984, Congress passed the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act, and in that act, they said that the states will put together a series of child support guidelines that will apply equally across all of the judicial districts in each of the states, and the failure to do so will imperil your right to age-dependent children support from the federal government. So in 1985, the Nebraska legislature passed 42364, parenthetical 16, and charged this court with creating child support guidelines. And about the only direction they gave you is that these guidelines must be fair and equitable. And so time passed, and the United States Department of Health and Human Services got into the act and published a document called the Development of Guidelines for Child Support Orders, commonly referred to as the Child Support Guideline Bible. However, it was published in 1987. So when you turn to page 67 of the Bible...
Is the Bible in our record?
Is it in evidence? No, it's not. Starting out to discuss the income shares model, it says so far the income shares model has been adopted in Colorado, Maine, Michigan, Nebraska, New Jersey, and Vermont. So we should be proud of ourselves. We beat most states in adopting guidelines to be used by the district and county courts in the state of Nebraska. So why am I standing here today? There's a conflict between 4201 and 4204. 4201 says that guidelines will be based upon the net incomes of the parties. And 204 says that child support is to be determined based upon the income from all sources.
What about 4205 that lists the things that we deduct out of income?
It doesn't exclude alimony.
It doesn't include alimony in the list of things that are included.
That's true, but it doesn't exclude alimony either.
Have we ever included anything else that's not on the list?
No. What I find interesting about it is that 4213, which is the section that says we're going to calculate child support before we calculate alimony, has been there from the very beginning, from the adoption. So when you go back and you look at the Bible, what I find interesting, permit me to read this, it's not very long. The income shares model calculates child support as the share of each parent's income estimated to have been allocated to the child or children if the parents were still living in an intact household. A basic child support obligation is computed based upon the combined income of the parents, and there's a parenthetical, replicating total income in an intact household. So you could take that and suggest that if you're looking at it from an intact household standpoint, there would be no alimony. And therefore, perhaps the persons who authorized the initial child support guidelines, this court, looked at that principal and said, we're going to insert 4213 to require the intact principal concept by calculating child support first and then calculating alimony. Now, the situation in this case is a little bit different because it came up on a modification filed by the former Mrs. Hotz and was asking that one of the children go from Dr. Hotz and said, well, we back up. Dr. Hotz had two children, the two boys. Mrs. Hotz had the daughter. And she wanted to modify that to move one of the boys over to her household. So I then filed a counterclaim seeking to reevaluate child support and include it in my calculation alimony, because clearly by Dr. Hotz paying alimony, it's a fictitious net income figure because he doesn't have that money because he is paying alimony. So we're calculating child support based upon income that he doesn't have.
Counsel, how have we treated alimony as income for child support purposes in the past?
I'm going to step out here and be a little bold, okay? There is one state, that permits the deduction of alimony in the calculation of child support, but does not include it in the recipient's income for the purposes of calculating child support. And if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. Because this court has said on hundreds of occasions, what is the purpose of alimony? I think that alimony serves a completely different purpose.
So back to my question, how have we treated it?
How is it treated in Nebraska?
How is it treated in Nebraska?
You don't include it, you don't subtract it, period.
You're asking for a fundamental change.
Pardon?
You're asking the court to consider a fundamental change in the way we interpret our child support rules. Is
exactly.
That fair?
Exactly.
What would be the practical effect of something like that? Help me think through that.
Well, the practical effect, if you include it as income for the recipient and deduct it as an expense for the payer or the recipient, doesn't make any difference. Those are the real numbers. I mean, that's the real world. I mean, if you're looking at money, somebody's receiving income, the other party is taking some of their income and passing it on to somebody else.
Is that true under the new tax?
Pardon?
Is that true under the new federal tax law?
Well, you report alimony as income to the Internal Revenue Service and you deduct it as an expense on your 1040.
Is that the law?
That is the law.
Subsequent to the new reform tax law.
With the Internal Revenue Service, yes.
Didn't the new law change that effective 1 year later?
I'm not aware of that.
Well, assume for the moment that it did.
Okay.
That alimony will no longer be deductible to the payor or includable to the payee. If I may interrupt,
no longer the mirror image.
Right.
In the universe of
tax. That would be totally consistent with the current guidelines then. Would it not? Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Thank you very much. Mr. Dawson, good morning to you.
Before your comments, I want to apologize for jumping in on Judge Castle's good question.
May it please the court, my name is Brad Dawson. I'm from North Platte, Nebraska, and I represent the appellee in these proceedings, Ms. Barbara Hotz. Obviously, Mr. Schroeder and I have significant differences of opinions when it comes to how alimony is treated with respect to the determination of child support. Section 213 of the Nebraska Child Guidelines specifically says that it's the intention of the guidelines that alimony be addressed after child support is established. My presumption that the reason we have such an intention is because we don't want one duty of support supporting another duty of support. And if in fact we added alimony into a child support calculation, we're subsidizing the child support calculation by the duty to support a former spouse. Seems to me that that's the intention, not the intention of the guidelines. And in fact, what they want is a very orderly process of determining an amount payable for the minor children of the parties, once that's determined, then we look at the residual incomes, who has what. She has receipts of child support. He's paying child support. Then in that fact, if we're paying the wife alimony, we're going to look at the numbers and see what's available for that payment. And it seems to me that that's the system we have. And I don't know of any reason in the world why we would change that. It seems to be a very successful reason.
Are there any problems with changing it? If we reversed it, what if anything would happen?
In my opinion, what you would do is cause one duty to support to subsidize another. And I don't know of any better way to put it in that fashion. If we add alimony back into the calculation, and let's say in the case of the Hots, where alimony is already a known figure, we know that he owes $750 a month in alimony. Add that back into her income. He not only has the tax deduction for that until 2019, but he also now has that number subsidizing the support obligation because it's bumped her income up higher, which in this particular case is going to increase her obligation to her former husband for the support of the two minor children in his care. So it seems to me that the purpose of 213 is to avoid that kind of subsidizing and just allow things to flow the way they were. And if we determine, let's take an example, let's say we determine that child support is a science, alimony is an art. We determine the science first and then address the art. There are no formulas for the determination of alimony. There's a very strict formula for the determination of child support. And because of that, because there's a lack of a formula for the determination of alimony, it's necessary to run through the calculation promulgated by the guidelines of this court. Gallner, which is a case decided, I believe, in 2002, roughly 6 years ahead of the time our current set of guidelines have been enacted, specifically found that the inclusion of alimony is inappropriate. As a question of law was presented to the Gallner court said this is not an appropriate consideration, that the trial court's consideration of alimony income was clearly erroneous, and reversed the decision based upon those facts. Gallner was decided in 2002, guidelines enacted in 2008. Clearly, if somebody wanted to address the effect of alimony upon the consequences of child support, the opportunity had been there for some years, because Gallner clearly said that that's an inappropriate inclusion of income. So the fact that the court and through its commission did not include alimony as a deduction or address whether it's to be included in net income or gross income, leads me to believe that they intended for the system to remain intact, where we do the math, determine the amount, and then look at the art and determine the amount. And it seems to me that's the only way in which this case or these guidelines would make sense. The other issues brought by Mr. Schroeder regard depreciation, and that is not troubling to me either. The guidelines clearly establish a methodology for claiming the allowance of depreciation, and Dr. Hotz didn't follow those guidelines. The first requirement of claiming depreciation or the allowance for depreciation is you turn over 5 years' tax returns 14 days ahead of the hearing regarding child support and the determination of child support. That was not done in this case. Additionally, there has to be evidence that the assets being depreciated are ordinary and necessary for the conducting of the business. That was not done in this particular case.
So was there any testimony about depreciation?
Not until the motions for new trial and the motion for reconsideration. Because of that, the court finds that they didn't comply with the requirements of the child support guidelines with respect to the allowance of depreciation, and adopted a calculation I prepared for the court's benefit where I looked at the tax return, added in the depreciation, added in the Schedule E depreciation, and determined a monthly gross income amount for Dr. Hotz. And the court adopted that number specifically. I don't think that calculation is wrong. I think that calculation is correct. I think that's how it should be done, since he didn't properly do the procedures to claim the allowance for depreciation. Mr. Schroeder, in his brief, argues that Schedule E depreciation is already straight-line depreciation, and I would agree with him. It is. By all intents and purposes, it's a straight-line calculation. The problem is that he didn't comply with the prerequisite, which was to turn over those 5 years of tax returns to the trial court or me, file a certificate of service, in fact, that he had done so, so that we all knew that the claim of depreciation was an issue for the court to decide at the time of trial. Because of that, it was not addressed. Because of that, the court found when we filed the motion to alter or amend judgment that, in fact, it wasn't done correctly and denied the application. The other claim Mr. Schroeder makes in his brief is the court's allocation of the 3 months of summer abatement for child support. 3 months when they're doing a week-by-week rotation of all three children or the months of June, July, and August. The court clearly has that power. It's allowed by the guidelines. Matter of fact, the number of 80% is even suggested by the guidelines as a maximum amount. In view of the fact that the time's 50-50, I don't see why the court wouldn't adopt an 80% ruling with respect to that abatement.
Was the visitation schedule different after the modification than before the modification?
Slightly, yes, it was. There was more time with mother, but only as affected the two minor children, or the two minor sons. With respect to the daughter, she was on her way to college, so there is no sense in addressing what visitation rights they would have with regard to Josie. But with respect to the two boys, there was a modification. The modification was consistent with what the guardian ad litem had recommended and what my client was seeking. It wasn't as all-encompassing as what my client asked for with respect to the modification of parenting time, but it was pretty consistent with waking hours as to what she arrived at. So it's my opinion that there was a modification of the parenting plan, that there was more time for her. But the summer rotation of time had been ongoing for some time, although it was an agreement of the parties. It was done by arrangement of the parties, not necessarily by court order in the body of the decree. That is it. Those are the three main objections raised in his brief. If the court has no further questions, I have nothing else. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
1 minute.
1 minute and 38 seconds. Mr. Schroeder.
Just very briefly with respect to the depreciation deduction. When the burden of proof is on us to show what the depreciation is, I'm not sure that this court has ever defined what our burden of proof is. I mean, if you introduce the tax returns and the commercial property in which the doctor examines horses can only be depreciated in a 39-year straight-line method, that should speak for itself. With respect to the other depreciation on equipment, et cetera, I think the accountant was using 150% or double deduction, whatever it was. It doesn't make any difference. You can simply take the cost over the 7-year period and use the straight line method. I don't see that math as being all that difficult. With respect to the abatement in the summertime, it is true the judge asked me if that would be an appropriate abatement. I did say, yes, I agree that would be an appropriate abatement. Unfortunately, I had forgot that the parties had split the summer visitation, 6 weeks with mom, 6 weeks with dad, and so the abatement really is already in place. So that was an oversight on my part. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next case.